You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Join Wondery Plus to listen to American innovations 1 week early and ad-free in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. CIA campus, Langley, Virginia, October 7th, 2001. Inside an unassuming double-wide trailer, Air Force pilot Scott Swanson stares intently at infrared images on a video screen as he manipulates a joystick controller. He's remotely flying a high-tech unmanned drone called a Predator. His mission commander, Mark Cooter, sits a few feet behind him, issuing orders through his headset.
Maintain hold over the target.
Copy that. The Predator is some 7,000 miles away, hovering 3 miles above the city of Kandahar in Afghanistan. It's less than a month after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and this is the first night of Operation Enduring Freedom, the U.S. military campaign against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The Predator is surveilling Osama bin Laden's second-in-command, Taliban Supreme Commander Mullah Omar. Swanson and Cooter watch as a three-vehicle convoy pulls into a walled compound of rectangular buildings. Omar is believed to be in one of those vehicles. Swanson stays glued to the aerial view on the screen, watching as the vehicles cross a small bridge over a creek. One truck stops just beyond the bridge, and a couple of armed men hop out. Swanson gently applies pressure to the joystick, shifting the plane's movement, much as one might in a video game. Next to him, sensor operator Jeff Guay, nicknamed Gunny, keeps the Predator's infrared camera focused on the compound. Swanson stays cool and professional, but under his uniform, his heart is racing. That's because, for the first time, the Predator drone he's flying has been armed. At any moment, he could be given the order to fire the Predator's two Hellfire missiles, striking the first blow in America's war on terror. Swanson and Gunny wait patiently. They can hear Cooter behind them, talking quietly on a secure chat line with the CIA Global Response Center. Finally, he gives an update.
They want to put irons on the target.
Irons are bombs, not Hellfire missiles. That means they're calling in an airstrike by fighter jets, using the Predator strictly as a scout, not an attack vehicle. Swanson lets out a sigh, but otherwise manages to hide his disappointment. An hour passes. Still no airstrike. Swanson keeps the Predator circling above Mullah Omar's compound. Finally, getting impatient, he turns to Gunny.
What are we waiting on?
Cooter hears him and answers over the headset.
See that tiny building in the rear of the compound? They think it could be a mosque. We're still holding.
Swanson understands. Bombing a mosque would be a PR nightmare for the U.S. But then, just moments later, the strategy abruptly changes.
Captain Swanson, you are cleared to fire at the vehicle by the bridge.
Copy. This is it. The moment he's been waiting for, training for. Swanson maneuvers the Predator into position. Gunny locks the laser targeting onto the truck. Swanson quickly types a series of commands, then flips open a safety cover on the top of his joystick, revealing a red firing button. His thumb hovers over it as he does his final countdown. 3, 2, 1. Weapons away! He presses the button, then watches a heat flare from the launched missile cloud the entire screen. He glimpses the Hellfire missile for just a second before it arcs out of view of the Predator's camera. For what feels like an eternity, but is really only 20 seconds, the entire room falls silent. Everyone holds their breath as the Hellfire races towards its target. Then, still in eerie silence, their video screens flash bright. It's a direct hit. The vehicle is incinerated, killing anyone near it instantly. As the bloom from the explosion dissipates, Swanson sees an object flipping like a rag doll tossed in the air. It's a human body, glowing in the infrared of the Predator's camera. More luminous figures appear, this time pouring out of the compound and dropping to the ground, assuming combat positions. It's clear to Swanson that the men below think they're under attack from a large field across their compound. They have no idea they were struck from an aircraft 10,000 feet above them, controlled by a pilot halfway around the world. Swanson and Gunny trade high fives. The moment is historic. Swanson is the first person to pull the trigger on a lethal missile strike from an unmanned drone. A new way of waging war has begun.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is American Innovations. Drones have become a part of everyday life. You've seen their majestic aerial shots used in films and TV shows. You might have even seen one flying overhead the last time you were at an outdoor concert or sporting event. In the military, drones have been important surveillance tools and, sometimes, remote-controlled killing machines. In 2001, shortly after the 9/11 attacks, the Predator drone became the first unmanned aircraft in history to kill people while being operated by pilots halfway around the world. In stark contrast to military fighter jets, the Predator is not an imposing flying machine. It's actually slow and cumbersome. With its 48-foot wingspan, it resembles an oversized, windowless glider. But its uses are multifaceted. Predators can shine a laser beam on targets to guide fighter jets, eavesdrop on enemy communications, and give commanders a detailed overhead view of the battlefield. And, perhaps most significantly, they can be armed. The use of drones in targeted killings has become a routine part of modern warfare. President Obama authorized more than 500 drone strikes during his 2 terms in office. President Trump approved hundreds more, including one in January of 2020 that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Drone strikes are often criticized for lacking accountability and killing innocent civilians alongside intended targets. But the American people largely support the use of drones. Simply put, they reduce the need to put U.S. troops in harm's way. Still, many question whether there are moral ramifications to this remote-controlled warfare. Do drones reduce the horrors of war to something akin to a video game? The U.S. military tinkered with the concept of pilotless aircraft as far back as World War I. In 1944, the Army experimented with radio-controlled B-17 bombers, packed with explosives and rigged to be used as flying airborne bombs. But such early efforts were unsuccessful. It took the talents of a gifted Israeli engineer working out of his Southern California garage to jumpstart a revolution that would, for better or worse, forever change the face of modern warfare. This is episode 1 of our 3-part series on the Predator drone, from Albatross to Amber. Spring 1978. Tel Aviv, Israel. Abe Karam, one of Israel's most brilliant engineers and aviation designers, has just returned home from work. Tired and frustrated, he sinks into a large armchair, holding his balding head as if in pain. His wife, Dina, petite and soft-spoken, sits by his side.
Abe, is everything all right?
I'm finished in Israel, D.
Oh, come on. They won't buy anything from me. First, I design a drone that could patrol our borders, but they don't want that. Then they ask me to design an unmanned helicopter, which is a stupid idea. But I do it because I love my country. And today, my 9th rejection. 9 different designs for this helicopter, 3 years, not a single sale. They killed my company, just like they said they would.
Who? Who did this?
It's no mystery. IAI did.
IAI is Israel Aircraft Industries, the most important aerospace company in the country, where Karam was once a rising star. But after feeling stifled by its rigid structure and wasted resources, he quit and formed his own company.
They said when I left they were going to crush my company, and now they've made good on their promise. I'm sure they had something to do with my designs being rejected. I should have never left.
But you hated it there. You said it was too corporate.
It was. And you're right, I did hate it. And there's no going back. So, I need a scotch.
Dina goes into the kitchen to fix them both a drink. For Abe, Dina is his rock. She's a lively, bright woman who met Karam in 1965 while serving her 2 years of obligatory military service. She became Karam's biggest fan and supporter, helping him launch gliders at his free flight competitions and marveling at his ingenuity when it came to designing anything that could fly. Abe follows her into the kitchen, still venting his frustration.
But what I never understood with IAI was I worked faster and cheaper than anyone at their company. And because of that, they consider me a threat?
Dina bursts out laughing and hands her husband a scotch.
Well, of course they would, Abe. They were afraid you'd undercut their business. Maybe you need to play their game. Why not team up with someone else?
No, there's no one else. Not in Israel. Anyway, I'm tired of teams. I'm tired of working with incompetence. I can get twice the work done with half the amount of people.
So what are you going to do?
Karam takes his wife's hand, squeezing it affectionately.
After all I've tried to do for my country, no one could accuse me of betraying it if I left. And that time has come.
To leave Israel?
And you have a plan?
Abe's words spill out in an excited rush.
We will go to America. Southern California, to be exact. They have some of the best weather in the world, especially for flying. All the best aviation companies are there. The best engineers, subcontractors, parts, supplies, materials. I'll have everything I need to build whatever I want.
He stops suddenly, anxiously regarding his wife, who looks noncommittal.
I'm sorry, I talk too much. What do you think?
Well, I've always wanted to see America, and you have to take me to Beverly Hills.
They share a warm embrace. Abe raises his glass for a toast.
To America, and new beginnings.
For Abe Karam, a pivotal chapter in his life has closed. He was born in Baghdad in 1939, and his family emigrated to Israel when he was 12. Even as a toddler, Karam loved taking things apart to see how they worked. He eventually spent 9 years as an aeronautical engineer in the Israeli Air Force. There, during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, he produced his first invention, an unmanned glider that served as a decoy to steer anti-aircraft fire away from piloted planes. Building the glider led Karam to an epiphany. An unmanned, remote-controlled aircraft, outfitted with, say, an anti-tank missile, could be a powerful new weapon for the military. More importantly, it could lead to a world in which human pilots would no longer have to fly dangerous reconnaissance missions over enemy territory and risk being shot down. In 1978, Abe and Dina Karam leave Israel and head to Los Angeles. They go house hunting in the suburbs, but can't find anything they agree on. Dina jokes that she's looking for a house with a garage attached, and Abe is looking for a garage with a house attached. He's determined to find a space big enough to turn into a workshop. Finally, they tour a picture-perfect, Spanish-styled house on a hill in Hacienda Heights, a middle-class suburb just east of downtown. It has everything Dina wants. Big bedrooms, an updated kitchen, lots of natural light. And it has exactly what Abe wants. A huge 3-car garage with over 600 square feet of floor space. As soon as they step into it, Dina turns to her husband and sees his eyes light up. Do you like it? It's perfect. By the way, did you know the Wright brothers invented their first aircraft in a bicycle shop? I did not know that. They did. And I'm going to make history too, from this little garage. Dina smiles, knowing her husband well enough not to doubt him. It's summer 1983. Karam's garage in Hacienda Heights. 5 years after he and Dina moved in, it's now crammed full of tools, computers, and handmade molds to fabricate aircraft parts. Karam and two assistants work diligently, putting the finishing touches on his newest drone prototype, the Albatross. It's meant to be a technology demonstrator, so it's not much bigger than a model, with an odd cigar-like shape. It's got a 15-foot wingspan and is lightweight, made largely of mahogany plywood, spruce, and urethane foam. With the Albatross, Karam is determined to prove to potential customers that a drone can stay airborne not just for hours at a time, but for days, far longer than any piloted aircraft. One of Abe's helpers looks up as he attaches sensors to the drone's underside. So, how did you come to call it the Albatross? The Albatross is a seagoing bird that can glide over the ocean for hours at a time looking for fish. And that's exactly what this Albatross is going to do, just glide for hours. As soon as Jack here finishes building the radio control system. Just as he did in Israel, Abe works with a small team. One man is a pre-med student, who also makes models of free-flight gliders. The other is an electronics engineer named Jack Hertenstein, an expert in every aspect of radio control and aviation electronics. Hertenstein responds to Karam's challenge. I'm almost done with the radio controls. Now I just have to figure out how to run the autopilot. As long as you can figure out how to fly it without crashing it like I did. You were using electronics bought from a subcontractor. That was before you called me. Karam chuckles. I couldn't afford you before. Now that I finally got some government money, I can. The Albatross is being funded by the U.S. Defense Department's research arm, best known as DARPA. So far, they've mostly left Karam alone to tinker in his garage. But he knows it won't be long before they expect to see some return on their investment. Karam wipes the sweat off his forehead and studies his creation, smiling with pride. It's almost ready for its next test flight. And this time, there will be a lot riding on the Albatross's performance. It's November 30th, 1983. At El Mirage Airfield, on a dry lake bed in the Mojave Desert, the Albatross is about to undergo a test flight in front of some VIP guests, two Air Force engineers sent by DARPA. Karam stands like a proud papa beside the drone. Jack Hertenstein and Karam's student helper stand by his side. Karam gives the DARPA men a short briefing. So the Albatross has detachable landing gear and a nose wheel that lets it take off like a regular plane. It can carry a television camera in the nose. It's even got a parachute for emergency landings. The engineers look unimpressed. And to be fair, the Albatross isn't much to look at. One runs his hand over its tail, frowning. How much does it weigh? About 200 pounds, fully fueled. Keep in mind it can carry 95 pounds of fuel, which should give it lots of endurance in the air. It should be able to stay aloft for many hours, making it an excellent tool for intelligence gathering and reconnaissance. Karam turns to Hertenstein. Jack here did the radio control on avionics. He'll be the primary operator of the autopilot. Jack, you want to say a few words? Over the past 2 years, we've upgraded every piece of equipment. I mean, the autopilot system measures air pressure at the wingtips and stabilizes the plane as it flies. And there's a data link that will beam info to the ground, things like speed, altitude, and climb ratio. Now we'll see it fly. Karam can't wait to show off his creation, but he can't read the expressions on the DARPA engineers' faces. Karam is confident that the Albatross will work as he designed it, but his old mistrust of military officials and government bureaucrats creeps into his mind. Will they be able to see the potential? Karim and his student helper retreat to a nearby camping trailer. The trailer has been converted to a makeshift ground control station, outfitted with a small control panel with a couple of TV monitors and joysticks. Karim will fly the Albatross with the joysticks. Hertenstein stands by outside with a radio control box to take over the plane if necessary. Soon, the Albatross glides down the runway and goes airborne. The Air Force engineers watch it as it circles a 2-mile aerial course about 1,000 feet overhead. Some 3.5 hours later, Hertenstein advises Karim to land the plane because it's getting dark, and the Albatross has no lighting system. Karim runs out to the runway to check the Albatross's gauges. He's gratified to see that the plane's fuel monitor shows it could have remained airborne for another 48 hours or so, up to 10 times longer than any unmanned aerial vehicle has ever flown. Karim looks up from the Albatross's gauges and sees the Air Force engineers standing over him. For the first time, one of them breaks into a smile.
"I'll be honest, Mr. Karim, when we first laid eyes on this bird, we thought it would never live up to the design specs you sent us. But you've pulled it off."
After the Albatross's exceptional performance, DARPA offers Karim a $5 million contract to develop an even more advanced drone called the Amber. And when the Amber prototype proves sound, the Navy invests another $25 million. By July 1985, the Army joins the program, raising the total Amber budget to $40 million. The funding allows Karim to form a new company, which he calls Leading Systems, Inc. He's no longer an obscure inventor working out of his garage. He moves his operations to a gleaming new 180,000-square-foot headquarters in nearby Orange County. Over the next 4 years, Karim works like a man possessed. After years of being overlooked and misunderstood, he feels that his vision for a new era of unmanned aircraft is finally about to become a reality. The sky, indeed, is the limit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
It's May 13th, 1988, San Diego, California. Abe Karim is at Brown Field, an old U.S. Navy training base 1.5 miles north of the Mexican border. He's participating in a trade show called Airspace America 88. Aircraft manufacturers, military officers, political leaders, and flying aficionados from around the globe are here to learn about the latest innovations in aviation. A crowd gathers around Karim's Leading Systems booth, checking out the Amber, his latest unmanned aircraft. A visitor studies a brochure and turns to Karim.
"Is this a spy plane?"
"Amber is a reconnaissance drone. It's capable of many things." Outside the booth, visitors gawk and snap photos of a full-scale model of the drone. It's orange and white, and standing on its tail, its nose nearly reaches the ceiling of the 2-story tent. Abe spots a couple of men in gray suits loitering by the display. From their close-cropped haircuts, he guesses they're military guys, and therefore potential customers. He turns his full attention to them.
"Just so you know, Amber holds 3 times as much fuel as my last drone, Albatross. And fuel is key, because the Amber is going to help the military conduct surveillance missions, so it needs to be able to loiter in the sky for as long as possible. How long can it stay in the air? We'll be testing it next month, where hopefully we will show that Amber can stay aloft for more than 48 hours. One of the men picks up a brochure and leafs through it. Looks like there's a few different models? Yeah, correct. I've designed different versions of Amber. 3 different fuselages. One has a nose shaped like a snake's head that can carry both video cameras and small radar. Karam hands the man a second brochure. And this version, with the nose, you know, bulging downward, can carry moving target indicator radar to identify objects in motion on the ground. And then there's a third version that has a missile-shaped nose, which could carry a warhead. So you see this being used in combat. Eventually, yes, that's the goal. An eavesdropping man, a veteran in uniform, pushes forward to ask a question. Could it be launched from a Navy ship? That's a good question. I have another model designed with the Navy in mind. One that could be launched at sea from a torpedo tube or a canister. The gray-suited military men are still flipping through their brochures. I'd really love to see this thing in action. Well, we're doing a demo in a couple of weeks, not far from here. Here, in case you can attend. Karam hands them another brochure, and the military men move on, duly impressed. A few weeks later, on the morning of June 6, 1988, the Amber glides down a runway and lifts off from El Mirage Airfield. The goal of the flight is simple, to see just how long the drone can remain airborne. After an astounding 38 hours and 22 minutes in the sky, the Amber lands just after 10 p.m. on June 7th. They've set a record, logging several hours more than any other drone has ever stayed aloft. Karam is exultant. He's got a record-breaking aircraft on his hands, and he's in talks with the Navy to build 96 Ambers capable of launching from a ship or from the ground. Finally, the potential of his unmanned aerial vehicles is being recognized. Everything is looking up. But soon, Karam discovers that being a defense contractor for the U.S. military is no better than his frustrating days working for the Israeli military. It's December 1988. Karam stands over a drafting table at his leading systems office. Next to him stands a Marine officer from the Unmanned Air Vehicle Joint Program Office, or JPO. Thanks to some reshuffling from the Pentagon, Karam has to run all his Amber design modifications through JPO, rather than his old contacts at the Navy. And he hates it. As far as he's concerned, this Marine, this JPO overseer, is just another mindless bureaucrat. Karam points to a set of mock-ups for his latest design. This version of Amber would be launched from a shipboard canister with a booster rocket. The wings and stabilizers would fold into the fuselage in preparation for the launch. That's exactly what the Navy asked for. Well, no, not exactly. I mean, this is far more elaborate than the last design you showed us. We need to stick to something that's much more cost-efficient. Again, with money, is this the time to be worrying about costs? I want the best versions of the Amber we can get. That's your problem, Abe. You never think about money. Your spending is out of control. Yeah, and your problem is you don't have a creative bone in your body. They glower at each other, the irresistible force and the immovable object. It's February 1989. At the Karam home in Hacienda Heights. Abe Karam is just returning home from work when he hears the phone ringing in his office. He races in to answer it. Hello?
Abe, it's Ira Kuhn. Are you sitting down?
Kuhn is the DARPA contractor Karam goes through for all his military contracts. If he's calling Karam at home this late, it's probably not good news. Karam sinks into his desk chair.
Yes, I'm sitting down. What's going on?
I'm sorry to report that the Navy pulled the plug on your Amber deal. They're not going to be buying them.
All 96? What happened?
It's got nothing to do with you, Abe. It's just money. The Navy's moving ahead with a smaller, short-range drone they think will cost less to develop.
You mean the Pioneer?
Yes, the Pioneer.
Karam sighs and rubs the top of his bald head. When he read a recent article about the Pioneer program, he was afraid it might compete directly with the Amber. And to add insult to injury, The Pioneer is being developed by a joint U.S.-Israeli team.
Abe, you still there?
I'm here. So, Israel beats me again.
For now, this isn't the end, Abe. Just a setback.
But when the conversation ends, Karim hangs up feeling defeated. No matter where he goes, no matter what kind of drone he designs, he can't seem to catch a break. It's spring, 1989, in Irvine, California. Karim is at the leading systems office, pouring coffee for one of his most trusted executives, a brilliant software engineer named Frank Pace. The two men are discussing a potential lifeline, JPO, the Unmanned Air Vehicle Joint Program Office. JPO has invited companies to compete for a lucrative contract to produce an improved unmanned aerial vehicle for the Army and Marine Corps. The deal could be worth as much as $1 billion. Pace gives Karim the lowdown. So they want a drone that can loiter over an area as far as 90 miles from its base for 5 to 12 hours. Well, 5 to 12 hours is nothing for the Amber. Yeah, but the Amber's never been that far away from its base. I can make it work. It won't be a problem. The winning bidder will be commissioned to build as many as 400 drones and 50 ground control systems within the next 5 years. Okay? Karim can sense Pace has something delicate to say. What? Is there something else? Abe, that's pretty significant production. I'm not saying we can't do it, but we're going to need to prove to the JPO that we have the facilities, the financial resources, and manpower. I mean, obviously we have the experience. It's the other stuff that concerns me. Especially our cash flow, which is getting low. What are you suggesting? We need to team up with a bigger company. It's our only shot at getting this. Out of the question. If we are going to win, I win on my terms, not with someone else interfering. They wouldn't be interfering. They'd be financing, helping with manufacturing. I've seen what happens with those big teams and big companies. They're a complete waste of ideas and resources. It's why I left Israel. Abe, we're not in Israel. And look, I have to be honest, you've gotten a reputation for being difficult to work with. Me? The JPO is full of incompetence. The last overseer they sent me didn't have a creative thought in his head. All they care about is pinching pennies. Will you at least sleep on it? Winning a contract like this would change your life. I don't sleep. Not lately. Pace shakes his head. But Karim's mind is made up. He won't commit to partnering with another company. He cannot bear the thought of anyone telling him what to do. By August of 1989, Leading Systems is even more strapped for cash. Try as he might, Karim can't find another buyer for the Amber. There's no money coming in. Running out of options, Karim bites the bullet and partners with Hughes Aircraft Company, a far larger and richer defense contractor with extensive manufacturing experience. He alerts the JPO about his new partnership. Hughes agrees to loan Karim's company $5 million. They also agree to take charge of mass production of the Amber, if it's chosen in the JPO's competition. But in September, the JPO notifies Hughes that they've decided to go with two other contractors. For Karim, it's a devastating blow. But he has one last-ditch possibility for keeping Leading Systems afloat. Because it was developed under a Defense Department contract, Karim can't legally sell the Amber to foreign militaries. But that rule doesn't apply to the new drone he's designed. It's a larger, heavier aircraft that's less capable than the Amber, but combines some of the Amber's best features with those from an older drone that he called the Nat. The new model is named the Nat 750. It's mid-October 1989 in Istanbul, Turkey. Karim sits in a conference room at the offices of a Turkish aircraft manufacturer, drinking tea. With him are potential buyers, a Turkish export agent and his partner. The agent leafs through a glossy brochure promoting the Nat 750, then leans forward. So it has a two-stroke Rotax 532 engine, but no canister launch capability. It seems less sophisticated than your Amber drone. Technically, yes, but it still retains some of Amber's best features, I mean, such as... The agent's partner interrupts. Why was Amber killed? Karam shrugs, throws up his hands.
It got lost in the bureaucracy. I mean, who really knows?
The export agents nod to each other, some kind of secret communication passing between them.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure we have enough demand right now, but call us in 3 months.
Karam slowly stands and exchanges handshakes. He walks quickly out of the room, his mind racing, already planning his next move. Over the next several weeks, Karam travels to Pakistan, Germany, and Washington, D.C. for similar meetings, all with the same results. Nobody is rushing to buy a drone in the current market. It's October 20th, 1989, in Hacienda Heights. Karam is in his study, punching the keypad of a calculator and sorting through piles of papers, bank account statements, and leading systems invoices. Dina walks up behind him and rubs his shoulders, but he shrugs her off.
Do you know what was supposed to happen today? The Kuwaitis were supposed to fly the Nat 750 for a demo, but they canceled the flight. Do you know why?
Why?
Because they found out I used to live in Israel. It happens, Abe. Nothing you can do.
Karam takes a deep breath.
Dina, Leading Systems is out of cash. I don't know what else to do. I mean, when I teamed up with Hughes Aircraft, they gave me a $5 million bank loan. Now the loan is due. I can't pay them back.
Then you file for bankruptcy.
That's what companies do to protect themselves.
Karam leans back heavily in his chair and sighs. Declaring bankruptcy feels like accepting defeat. It's the last thing he wants to do. Karam fights off his creditors for another year, but eventually he has to accept the inevitable. In October of 1990, Leading Systems files for bankruptcy. As part of the bankruptcy settlement, Hughes takes possession of all of Leading Systems' physical and intellectual property that doesn't belong to the government. It's Karam's lowest point yet. His company is bankrupt, his Amber drone is mothballed, and now that the Nat 750 belongs to Hughes, its future is uncertain. Plus, with the Cold War ending and defense budgets shrinking, demand for new technologies like unmanned aircraft is at its lowest point in decades. Karam is starting to wonder if his vision of an unmanned aerial vehicle will ever see the light of day.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's January 1991 in Irvine, California. In Leading Systems' nearly empty headquarters, Karam sits in his office with his old friend and DARPA connection, Ira Kuhn.
Abe, I might have a buyer for your company. I want you to listen seriously to what I have to say.
I'm listening.
Their name is General Atomics. The company's owned by two brothers, Neil and Lyndon Blue. They're rich. They're connected. And they've been trying to get into the drone business, just like you.
How so?
They had developed a drone called the Predator, but it had problems. The pilot never figured out how to make it fly in autopilot mode. So the military wasn't interested.
Of course not.
If they couldn't figure out the autopilot, why would they be?
But here's the thing. General Atomics needs someone like you. They have the financial wherewithal and all the resources you'd want. What they don't have is a visionary, someone who can design a drone with the kind of range and endurance the military is looking for.
But Congress cut the budgets. I thought nobody was interested in long-range drones.
Things change, Abe. Needs change. I've already spoken to the brothers. They want a meeting.
Karam isn't particularly interested in working with anyone who can't even figure out how to fly a drone on autopilot.
But he's running out of options, and he trusts Kuhn, so he agrees to meet with the Blue Brothers. Wealthy and handsome, the intrepid Blue Brothers have lived a charmed life. In 1957, they landed on the cover of Life magazine after flying a 4-passenger prop plane on a then-unprecedented tour of South America. They covered 25,000 miles in 110 days, crossed the Andes 9 times, and even survived a crash landing in Brazil. Life dubbed them the Flying Blue Brothers. After a 3-year stint in the Air Force, they formed an investment company and amassed a huge fortune in oil, gas, and commercial real estate. In 1986, they bought General Atomics from Chevron for $60 million. GA was originally a nuclear research company, but the Blue Brothers shifted its focus to aviation and spent the next several years trying to develop their own unmanned aircraft. Then, in 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, marking the end of the Cold War. President George H.W. Bush slashed defense spending, and government interest in drone technology dwindled. Still, Neil Blue's favorite mantra is, always buy straw hats in winter. And Leading Systems is certainly a straw hat. It's February 12, 1991, at Abe Karam's house in Hacienda Heights. He's on a call with Neil Blue. The two sides are trying to hammer out a deal that would bring Karam to General Atomics. Karam sifts through his handwritten notes while talking on speaker. So here's what I envision. General Atomics buys my company's assets from Hughes Aircraft and then invests $4 million over the next 2 years in a separate entity. This entity would be responsible for building unmanned vehicles, and I would be the supervisor of this entity. And I get an executive position with your company with a full compensation package plus royalties on any sale of Nat 750s as its inventor and lead designer. There's a rustling on the other end of the line. Then Neil speaks in polite but firm tones.
Abe, I'm happy to put you in charge of a new division, but not some separate entity. And I can't offer you any royalties. I can hire you and your core team as salaried employees of General Atomics, but that's the best I can do.
Salaried employees?
You would report to the head of our Advanced Technologies Group. You'll get the chance to work on many exciting projects.
Karam's heard that one before. He clasps his hands under his chin. Exciting projects that wouldn't be my projects.
I know it's not your ideal situation, Abe, but GA is a great company. You'll have the chance to do amazing things, help your country, change the world. We'll give you everything you need to make it happen.
I would have hoped for a more supervisory role.
Why don't you think it over and give me your answer in a few days? I don't think you're going to find another company willing to take on what's left of Leading Systems.
Karam hangs up with a sigh. He has no negotiating leverage, and the Blue Brothers know it. The next day, Karam accepts their offer. General Atomics agrees to buy the assets of Leading Systems from Hughes Aircraft. They get all of Leading Systems' intellectual property, including patents, trademarks, and copyrights. In March, General Atomics puts Karam and the other members of his Leading Systems team on salary. For the Blue Brothers, it's their biggest attempt yet to get General Atomics into the major leagues. A week later, Karam invites Dina to join him for lunch at the General Atomics cafeteria. Karam chooses a table in a secluded corner.
This looks like a nice place to work.
Karam mutters under his breath, barely looking up at her.
Yes, it's just wonderful.
That didn't sound very encouraging. Abe lowers his voice, looking around to make sure no one is nearby.
This is what I came to America for? To work as some lowly cog in a machine, dealing with stupid employees, helping rich people get even richer? It's like I'm right back where I was when I left Israel.
They finish eating in silence. It's early in the morning of March 1993, and Karam is driving to work, sipping coffee from a travel mug. His car phone rings, and he picks up.
Hello?
Hello, Abe. It's Jim Woolsey.
Karam nearly spits out his coffee. James Woolsey is a veteran military advisor he first met over a decade ago. And just recently, he became head of the CIA. He's the last person Karam would expect a phone call from.
Jim, hey, good to hear from you. What can I do for you?
I'm curious as to whatever happened to your Amber.
Well, none of the military services wanted it, so my company went bankrupt.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
I appreciate that, but the technology was bought by my new employer, General Atomics. We have about half a dozen of them sitting in a hangar in El Mirage. We call it the Nat 750 now because I've made some changes. It's basically the Amber, but improved.
Abe, this may be a crazy idea, but how long would it take you and how much would it cost to get the Nat up and flying over Bosnia?
In 1992, a bloody civil war broke out in the former Yugoslavian Republic of Bosnia in southeastern Europe. Officially, the U.S. hasn't gotten involved, but Karim isn't surprised to hear the new head of the CIA bring it up. He does a few quick mental calculations. Oh, let's see. I'd say 6 months and about $5 million.
Great. Let's see what you and General Atomics can do.
Karim hangs up the phone, his head spinning. This could be the kind of opportunity he's waited his whole career for. But now, he'll have to respond to it not as the boss or the inventor, but as the hired help. It's March 20th, 1993, at the El Mirage airfield. In a General Atomics baseball cap, Abe Karim stands on a runway alongside a group of CIA officials. He had hoped Woosley would come to see the Nat 750 in person, but he tries to hide his disappointment. A Nat 750 buzzes overhead on a demonstration flight. Its engine whirs loudly, like a small motorcycle. The head CIA official has to raise his voice over the noise.
Look, we're going to be using this thing for surveillance, so it's got to be really quiet. Don't worry, it will be. That's just a developmental engine. How long can it stay up? Like 24 hours? Oh, absolutely. On a full load of fuel, it can stay in the air for up to 40 hours, depending on other conditions, of course, like altitude, wind, weather, are all factors. How far can it fly from its ground control station? Right now, about 130, 150 miles, but it needs to stay within line of sight. So if there's a mountain or a tall building in its way, yes, that would be a problem. However, if a manned aircraft could fly above the drone at higher altitudes, that could provide a direct path of communication and improve its range. The men watch as the Nat comes in for a smooth landing. The CIA official turns to Karim and smiles.
Well, it may sound like a lawnmower, but it flies great. Thank you, Mr. Karim. We'll be in touch.
The way out of Mostar was across a littered no man's land.
Days later, Karim is at home, watching the evening news. The situation in Bosnia is getting worse by the day. Ethnic Serbs are laying siege to Sarajevo, Bosnia's capital city, and massacring Bosnian Muslims throughout the country. Karim turns the volume down on the TV and picks up the phone. Hello?
Abe, it's Lyndon Blue at GA. We just got a call from the CIA. Seems they want to fly your Nat 750 over Bosnia pronto.
Hey, that is amazing.
You did it, Abe. We're in business.
Karim hangs up, elated. For this moment, at least, all his past disappointments fade away.
Dina, I have some news.
The Nat 750 is about to get its first taste of combat, opening the door to a new era of aerial surveillance and warfare. It's what Karim always dreamed of when he was back in Israel, that someday a drone he invented could be deployed to serve and protect his country and its allies. Abe Karim is back in the game.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American Innovations ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Predator Drone on American Innovations. A quick note about the recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. If you want to learn more about the history of the Predator drone, we recommend Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution by Richard Whittle, and Never Mind, We'll Do It Ourselves by Alec Bierbauer and Colonel Mark Cooter. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson.
For more information on my books about science and innovation, including my latest, Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer, which is also a television series on PBS, you can visit my website, StephenBerlinJohnson.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Stephen B. Johnson. This episode was written by Graham Flaschner, with editing by Matt Almos. Audio post-production and sound design by Woodlands Audio. Produced by Emily Frost. Our senior producer is Andy Herman. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect forever.